I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On September 11th, 2012, the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, was attacked by militants, leading to the deaths of four Americans, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens. There have been numerous investigations into what led up to the attack and the actions and explanations by the Obama administration, including former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The House Select Committee on Benghazi just released their long-awaited report. It's 800 pages, the result of a two-year, $7 million investigation that often turned testy, with Republicans and Democrats accusing the other of politicizing the tragedy. The report faults the Obama administration for not taking security in Benghazi more seriously and for not responding more quickly to events on the ground. The report doesn't add much to what had already been reported about the role of Hillary Clinton, although Republican Congressman Jim Jordan and Mike Pompeo released their own addendum to the report that was very critical of Hillary Clinton. Well, joining us is Ben Brody. He writes for Bloomberg Politics from Washington, D.C., has been covering the story. And Ben, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Any new revelations from this report released yesterday?
Essentially not, especially vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton. As you mentioned, previous reports have looked into this. They came to very similar conclusions. There were bureaucratic issues that got in the way of rescuing those Americans and putting in place measures for their safety before the attacks. That overall theme is something we knew. Clinton's movements that night, the things she did, the things she didn't do, are essentially known to us beforehand. So in terms of something new, not much for Hillary Clinton, but potentially brings it anew into the election cycle.
Absolutely. I do want to talk about this. Now, this was the eighth investigation, according to my mathematical calculations, into what happened in Benghazi. Is that correct?
Seventh, eighth, it depends exactly how you count it. Different committees have looked into it, either in whole or in part. There are four or five major reports that we look at when we're sort of tabulating what has or has not been known before.
And what was the charge? I mean, this was an investigation that was called 2 years ago. What were they supposed to look into that was different from some of these other investigations?
Sure. Most of what they were to look into was to basically get at the bottom of it, to talk to everybody, to read every document, to take, you know, as much testimony as possible, to focus really on the entirety of the event, what led up to it, what could have been done. A lot of the reports previously focused either on oversight, that is to say the role of the State Department specifically, or various executive agencies, or of the intelligence community. Both intelligence committees, both the House and Senate, have released reports on this. And so in terms of its mandate, the idea was that it would step back and look at the totality of that. And in these 800 pages, you certainly get it reads like a Russian novel at times. Huh. You know, you're in Benghazi, you're at the White House, you're at the State Department, you're at the Pentagon. There are numerous storylines going on here.
What took so long? This was two-year long investigation, longer than I think it took for the September 11th investigation to take
place.
$7 million. What was either the holdup or what took so long?
Well, I think it depends who you ask. If you talk to congressional Democrats, they would tell you that the holdup was essentially they were waiting to exact maximum punishment on Clinton to pull her out in the fall and have her do 11 hours of testimony just as she was starting to pick up steam in her candidacy. And then yesterday, to release the report as close to the convention as possible. If you talk to Republicans, it's exactly the opposite. The delays have to do with stonewalling from the White House, from the State Department, and whole sections of the report were devoted to the idea that the government simply did not cooperate, did not fulfill subpoenas, and it is essentially the government and the administration's fault that the delay came on so long. The answer is probably somewhere in the middle. There was a lot of political infighting, certainly, and there was motivations on both sides to hold or move faster at various moments.
In fact, the Democrats released their report on Monday, This report, the official report came out yesterday, and then there were these two Republican congressmen who issued their addendum to this report. I guess that gives us a sense of just how divided and partisan it was on this committee.
Absolutely. I think this is best shown by the ranking member, the highest ranking Democrat, Elijah Cummings, and Trey Gowdy, who is the Republican, the chairman. They, by all accounts, actually like and respect one another. But in public and in statements, the talk between them could get quite personal, insults about their motivations, about politicizing tragedy, even sometimes where they came from. It could really get quite strident and quite personal. And I think, as you say, really goes to the point that this that the political infighting was certainly part of what made this take so long.
I heard an interview with Congressman Cummings yesterday, of course, a ranking Democrat on this committee, basically saying that we were shut out. We weren't even given a copy of this report. It was released before we actually had a chance to see it. Is that correct?
That's correct to everything I know. It's certainly something that the Democrats complained of earlier, that they weren't invited to this or that testimony, didn't receive this or that transcript. What goes on exactly in the halls of power and who forbids whom can be difficult to know. But it is certainly a charge that we have heard from multiple Democrats at multiple points over the course of this 2-year investigation.
This Jim Jordan, Mike Pompeo, their addendum said that Hillary Clinton and her leadership was morally reprehensible. That's a quote from their addendum.
Mm-hmm.
What are they saying?
They are basically saying that they're focusing on one issue in specific, which is Hillary Clinton's response to the attack during which she mentioned an anti-Muslim video that was creating protests, sometimes violent protests, in the Arab world at the exact same time as the attack. And it was confusing, I think, to the government whether exactly it had played a role. And to hear the Republicans tell it 8 weeks before an election at that point, it was crucial that they downplay that this was terror, that would hurt their reelection chances, and that they basically had to go with the spontaneous protest theory, and that Hillary Clinton in that moment was basically lying to the American people. And they also talk about the ways that the State Department did or did not respond to requests for increased security. So what are they saying? They're saying that factually, but they're also talking about the ways in which Jordan and Pompeo are considered in some ways more conservative on the spectrum of Republicans on the committee. And so they're speaking to the base. They're speaking to the base that is very doubtful about Hillary Clinton and believes that she played a role either actively or passively in these deaths, ultimately. And they are laying the charge out in these public documents that she was indeed involved in it. That's the red meat, as it were.
I mean, it seems like the main discovery of this 2-year investigation was that Hillary Clinton had a private email server when she was Secretary of State.
Certainly. That is one of the things that the committee uncovered. Trey Gowdy was very, very insistent that this was not about Hillary Clinton, that this was about, as I say, the totality of events, and was often quite sensitive to the suggestion that he was focusing on the emails. Nonetheless, I think it's undeniable that these basically came out because of the committee. They discovered the private email address as they were trying to get records from the State Department, and it ultimately became publicized. Now, it's unquestionable that Republicans asked questions about the email, the server, and email practices during the course of their investigation. Now, whether they focused on that, I think, is a question for debate, and there's plenty of other things they talk about in the report. But it's certainly something that they were interested in, and they saw I think, at times that it was politically useful to focus on.
You were there when Hillary Clinton testified, what is something like 11 hours last fall about?
I was, yes.
What was that like? For many people, I think they felt like she held her own and perhaps even, you know, helped her presidential aspirations at the time.
Correct. I think many people felt that she projected competence, strength, a very intense grasp of the material. She rarely looked at her notes. She seemed to be going off the top of her head and yet almost to be footnoted. The feeling was like being at a football game. It was reporters 300 deep in one of the bigger committee rooms in one of the office buildings on Capitol Hill, standing shoulder to shoulder, dozens of rows deep, reporters and spectators even, people who had taken the day off, often young people, lining the halls, trying to get in, haggling with security, and then reporters on other levels, sitting on the floor, filing in the hall, typing on their computers, some of them upstairs perhaps, watching from an overflow rooms. It was really, it was quite a spectacle. It was something of a game day for Washington, D.C.
There's also Congressman McCarthy. What had he said that seemed to, again, sort of politicize this whole issue?
Well, he said that it was political. he is, of course, the House Majority Leader. He's a representative from California. And he said back in October, essentially, when asked, what has the committee come up with if, as you say, there were all these investigations before? And he basically said, well, look at Hillary Clinton's poll numbers, and we discovered the emails. Did not make Trey Gowdy happy. He basically said that he hasn't, Leader McCarthy hasn't been in these testimony rooms any more than the Democrats had. But it was, it became a central talking point of the Democratic response that even Kevin McCarthy says this was essentially set up to focus on Hillary Clinton and to be a political event.
Ben, about a minute before we have to take a very short break, does this select committee put this issue to rest from what you can glean?
I think it puts many of the factual issues to rest. There is no question that this is an issue that for many hardcore Republicans in the base will always resonate and can always whip them up. But for the most part, it puts many of the factual questions to rest. The Republicans would say they still didn't get some documents, but I think it's hard when you have 800 pages to say that there is much more to discuss or much more to read.
That's Ben Brody. He writes for Bloomberg Politics from Washington, D.C. And we've been talking about the Select House Committee or House Select Committee on Benghazi. They just issued their final report yesterday, finding no particular evidence of wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, although it does give some more information about what happened almost 4 years ago in Benghazi, Libya. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. And we have Philip Bump from The Washington Post who will be joining us as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about the report released yesterday, 800 pages report by the House Select Committee on Benghazi. And it does detail some of the events or many of the events that happened in Benghazi, Libya, almost 4 years ago. And it also raises a couple of questions about the Obama administration's response. And it appears to not add much more fodder related to Hillary Clinton and what she did or didn't do, again, almost 4 years ago. Talking with Ben Brody, he writes for Bloomberg Politics from Washington, D.C. And joining us now is Philip Bump. He writes about politics for the Washington Post politics blog called The Fix. And Philip Bump, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Of course, my pleasure.
Let's talk a bit about Hillary Clinton, and not to overly politicize our conversation, but she obviously is running for president. What does this Benghazi committee do to her presidential aspirations, Philip?
I'm not sure it does a whole lot. I mean, one of the things that we've seen over the past few months is that a lot of the opinions on the Benghazi incident have been baked in, that people who disapproved of Hillary Clinton because of what happened on the night of the Benghazi attacks, disapproved of her from the outset. People who thought that she was exonerated in what happened have thought that essentially from the outset. The real damage that was done, as I think Benjamin was pointing out, was that, you know, this discovery of the email server, I think that still has legs. But I think that for the most part, opinions on what happened at Benghazi are not going to be moved one way or the other by this report.
Just because it has been talked about so much, I've sort of lost count how many times the word Hillary Clinton and Benghazi have appeared in the same sentence, Philip.
Yeah, that is a large part of it, but also because I think most people sort of reached a conclusion about what happened at the very outset in terms of what information they had available. I don't know. One of the things we've seen repeatedly over the course of this campaign outside of Benghazi is that more information isn't necessarily something that is moving people to change their minds, and I think that this is a very good example of that. I think that people who were willing to believe that Hillary Clinton acted in a way that was inappropriate believed that from the outset. I think that most people who disagreed with that sentiment from the outset as well. And I don't know that finding more nuanced information is going to do anything besides get people who already were skeptical of Clinton to point fingers and say, aha, and people who were already forgiving of Clinton to say, this is just more stuff that doesn't impact us.
Ben, let me go back to you. And Trey Gowdy basically said when he announced this yesterday is that, you know, take from this report what you will.
Correct. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he has at various times tried to step away from the partisanship. It's sort of the exact opposite approach of that Pompeo and Jordan addendum. So he has sort of put it out there and, has hoped that people will take their own conclusions. Now, he is certainly a Republican and a conservative Republican and has not necessarily been easy on Hillary Clinton. But in terms of the integrity of the committee, he has been jealous to guard that.
Well, let me go back to the report. I'll go back to you, Ben, but Philip, I want to get you back in on the conversation as well. One of the allegations against Hillary Clinton is that she ordered troops to, quote unquote, stand down. What does the report, Ben, say about that?
I simply think that there's nothing there to support that. Phil may have a different idea.
Yeah, Phil, go ahead.
No, agreed. I mean, there have been multiple reports, in fact, that showed that there was no validity to that claim.
But this is a claim that seems to live on, though, Phil.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I think a great lens through which to look at this is that Farley Dickinson did a poll in May of this year asking people about a slew of conspiracy theories. One of the conspiracy theories was that Hillary Clinton knew that Benghazi was going to happen and did nothing to prevent it. That was the most commonly believed conspiracy theory, including things like President Obama wasn't born in the United States, that George Bush let 9/11 happen. The Clinton-Benghazi conspiracy theory was the most commonly believed. And in fact, 50% of Donald Trump supporters believed that Hillary Clinton had knowingly let this happen, which, of course, there's absolutely no evidence for. But I think that shows that when people are considering this issue, I mean, there was an advisor to Donald Trump, an employee of the Trump Organization, who yesterday tweeted a thing saying that Hillary Clinton had murdered an ambassador. I mean, there is a level of emotion that is involved in this, tied up in this, that makes it difficult for the actual facts to have a hearing, in part because the emotions run both ways. People who think Hillary Clinton is guilty and who has behaved inappropriately are not going to be dissuaded by that any more than people who think that Hillary Clinton did absolutely nothing wrong may be dissuaded by evidence that there was something.
Phil, even more recently, or I guess last week, it was Donald Trump talking in his foreign policy speech, basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, that Hillary Clinton let Ambassador Stevens die while she slept. The idea that she somehow had blood on her hands for his tragic death, his tragic murder.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump's entire campaign has been predicated on this very extreme rhetoric and in, you know, raising people's concerns about terrorism and so on and so forth. He has not shied away from raising the most extreme conspiracy theories about Clinton more broadly. I think it's somewhat amazing that we're not even terribly surprised by that anymore. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's no evidence to that effect. But certainly the fact that Trump himself is willing to peddle in these ideas is one of the reasons that his supporters in particular particular are willing to embrace them.
Let me play a clip, and this is from yesterday. Hillary Clinton responding to the findings of the House Select Committee on Benghazi's report, and let's give that a listen.
So while this unfortunately took on a partisan tinge, I want us to stay focused on what I've always wanted us to stay focused on, and that is the important work of diplomacy and development. That's especially true in dangerous places. We cannot withdraw or retreat from the world. America needs a presence for a lot of reasons, and the best way to honor the commitment and sacrifice of those we lost is to redouble our efforts to provide the resources and support that our diplomats and our development experts deserve. I'll leave it to others to characterize this report, but I think it's pretty clear it's time to move on.
Ben, can she move on?
I think she absolutely can. I don't think, as Philip notes, that Donald Trump necessarily will move on. I don't think necessarily that his supporters will move on. It will continue to be motivating for them. But I think she can do what she essentially did in that speech, which is say this was partisan and then pivot to issues, pivot to something like a vision for America's role in the world. And that's typically how Hillary Clinton prefers to deal with major issues that come up when she is running for something. She calls it partisan, and she does her best to move back to issues. Now, what she does behind the scenes is often to fight it, but in public, that is a very frequent pivot of hers.
And, of course, adding to the fact that we had this terrorist attack in Istanbul yesterday, sort of adding to the intensity of this whole discussion about terrorism. Let me get some callers in the conversation. We've got David calling us from Flemington. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I believe that no matter how egregious anyone might think any issue is, the political polarization is so deep in this country that justice is virtually impossible for elected or appointed officials. Because when charges are made, the supporters line up and say it's just politics, and then the adversaries say, no, it's objective, it's not partisan, it's very serious, and it's just thought it's inert, it's all neutral.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, and I think, Phil, David speaks for a lot of people that just feel like, cannot we even come together on something as horrendous as what happened in Benghazi almost 4 years ago?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's 100% accurate. I mean, there's little question that there is. I mean, obviously, we've seen a lot of polarization, but we're also seeing in this election cycle that there is a lot of team boosting, if you will, that people who are on the Republican team or people who are on the Democratic team are rooting for their team, and that is the primary motivation, the primary lens through which people make political assessments. And, you know, I think that the parties have done a lot of work to make that the case because it obviously benefits them. But I think that point is right, that even if this were somehow literally the most objective thing that had ever been done, you know, I don't know how you would evaluate that, but even if that were somehow the case, that it would still be viewed through a partisan lens by members of each party.
Ben, let me go back to you and even back to this report and some of the other reports about why this U.S. compound in Benghazi didn't have the kind of security that clearly it needed. Now, the report said that there were calls for more security. The ambassador was there. What was the backstory about why this place was so vulnerable?
I think there are a number of issues. If you talk to Democrats, they typically say, well, Republicans cut funding for this kind of thing. Democrats or career government officials tend to say generally that they did the best they could. They are trying to secure diplomatic compounds all over the world and to figure out where those resources should be going. Ultimately, and I think what is detailed quite extensively in this report, is that there was a failure to recognize. Now, whether it was deliberate or not, I would doubt that it was, but they would suggest, Republicans would suggest that it was. There was a failure to recognize just how dangerous Libya was getting, and a failure to listen to partners like the UN, like the International Committee for the Red Cross, and like the UK, who were saying, we simply can't be in Benghazi anymore, and a failure to listen to sometimes the U.S. government's own warnings that things were getting more dangerous.
This was September 11th, after all, yes?
Incorrect. And the military and the White House had made clear. They expected that we should be on heightened alert in case anything should happen. It is a standard posture on September 11th for the last 15 years, they said they expected that, and it simply didn't translate into the ability to stop this, unfortunately.
Philip, you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, that's exactly right. But, again, this is one of those sorts of things that, not to be the guy that's always like, yes, but no one's going to pay any attention to that distinction. obviously the reason we're having this conversation is to raise those distinctions. But, again, this is something when we're looking at just the political effects of this, I don't know that particular detail is going to move anything one way or the other any more than anything else will.
And Ben, going back to you, ambassadors, there actually one of the revelations or one of the findings of this report was that Hillary Clinton was planning on going to this compound in Benghazi in, I think, October or November, sometime in the fall of 2012.
Correct. Actually, that's Democrats pushed back on the idea that was a new revelation. That had been testified to, alluded to at least in some of the earlier reports, and it's actually detailed in emails that were released very early on when we started to see the Clinton emails. 296 were released by the State Department that had also been released to the Benghazi Committee, and it makes very clear that Clinton was thinking about traveling there as. We were reading about it and talked about her earlier travel to Libya. The Clinton State Department and the Obama White House wanted Libya to be a victory, and I think it arguably is not. President Obama has said that it is one of his regrets, but they certainly wanted it to be a victory at that time, and that sort of travel was something that they wanted to come off quite well, and obviously was not able to.
And that's Ben Brody, writes for Bloomberg Politics. Also with us, Philip Bump. He writes about politics for the Washington Post blog, The Fix. And we are talking about the Benghazi report that came out yesterday. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Pat from media to join our conversation. Pat, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Am I wrong, but didn't Secretary Clinton ask for funds to secure the Benghazi compound, and Congress refused to fund it?
Can you answer that, Ben?
I believe that she, the State Department, would make these kinds of requests annually, and that Hillary Clinton was not involved in any specific requests for Libya. But I would need to do a little footnote digging to be absolutely sure that Phil may know.
Phil, let me just ask a couple of questions to you before we have to say goodbye to you. I was talking with Ben earlier about Hillary Clinton's testimony before the Benghazi Committee. This was, 11 hours of testimony. Did that in any way loosen the kind of criticisms or the hard feelings that so many people seem to have about her and what she did or didn't do related to Benghazi? Phil? We don't seem to have him. We're having
We may have lost him.
We may have lost him. Can you take that, Ben?
The question is?
Well, just Ben, Phil was talking about the fact that people just have made up their minds about which side of the Benghazi controversy that they are on. And I was just curious whether her testimony in the fall of 2015 in any way loosened people's views of what she did or didn't do, or whether it's just kind of hardwired at this point.
I think it's essentially hardwired. I think the one thing that the testimony did do that many people left and right agreed on was that Hillary Clinton essentially got the best of the testimony. She came out of it looking far more poised and far more in command of the material than the committee did. But I think essentially it is hardwired, as you say.
And this is a report. Is there going to be more testimony, more evidence? Is basically this select committee, are they done with their job, or is there more that they're going to do?
They've called this proposed or provisional. I forget the exact wording, but everything we have now basically leads us to believe that this this is the culmination of their work. There are bureaucratic measures. They could try to, you know, pass it through the committee as the official report and whatnot. But given the partisanship, the partisan nature of the committee, I think that sort of thing is pretty unlikely. So I think, yes, it's essentially the end of the report of the committee. You know, whether Congress at some other point may try to take up some other issue of this, for instance, State Department compliance, that's unclear. Mm. But right now, I think the committee's work is basically done.
I think we have Philip Bump back. Are you back with us, Phil? Are you back with us? No, doesn't seem like we do. Okay. I love when technology doesn't work and you're doing live radio. There's nothing like
always
it.
Fun.
Let me just read a quick comment here. This is from Patricia. She says, as a mother of a Marine, I cringe every time a journalist says there's nothing new that we didn't know before. This is not true of most people. Hillary Clinton will soon be nominated as commander-in-chief, and her conduct before, during, and after the Libyan regime change matters. The spin that was a YouTube video was misinformation. The attack was happening as troops changed uniforms three times because of the optics. The only troops that we deployed had to deploy themselves from Tripoli. And I appreciate Patricia's comments, because this is a deep tragedy about what happened. And there clearly were mistakes that were made. Ben, can you speak to that? Then we're going to take a very short break and then we'll continue our conversation. But go ahead.
Sure, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. It's a fundamental tragedy. And reading the report, there are detailed depictions, eyewitness reports of working through smoke-filled rooms, grenade fire, gunfire. It is absolutely fundamentally a tragedy. And I think that note goes to something else fundamental, which is that as much as Benghazi may be something that people want to focus on because it produces that visceral, emotional, partisan reaction that Philip talked about, there are legitimate questions, I think, more broadly about U.S. policy toward Libya, whether we made the right decision based on what we knew at the time, what we know now, and what we should do going forward. And I think those are very legitimate questions. And I think Republicans in particular are eager to ask them. But lots of people are eager to ask
Absolutely.
Them. It's a question of our foreign policy.
Well, in fact, I will ask them of you after this very short break. Ben Brody writes for Bloomberg Politics from Washington, D.C. And we are talking about the Benghazi report released yesterday. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the House Select Committee on Benghazi. They released their report yesterday. This was after a two-year investigation, a lot of finger-pointing by Republicans and Democrats who sit on this committee. The committee report does criticize the military response to the attacks on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, the lack of security at the facility. And we're talking about all of this with our guest. Ben Brody writes for Bloomberg Politics, has been covering the committee investigation. He was there when Hillary Clinton testified in the fall and walking us through some of the findings in this report. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play something that the head of this committee, Trey Gowdy, said yesterday. This was after this report, finding no evidence of wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, but certainly raising a whole host of questions about the response of the Obama administration.
Nothing could have reached Benghazi because nothing was ever headed to Benghazi. No U.S. military asset was ever deployed to Benghazi, despite the order of the Secretary of Defense at 7 o'clock that night. So Washington had access to real-time information, but yet somehow they thought the fighting had subsided. Washington had access to real-time information, but somehow they thought these fighters were going to evacuate, even without the remains of the ambassador. And without asking, how is that evacuation supposed to be effectuated? How were you supposed to get from the annex to the Benghazi airport? Because it took you almost 3 hours to get from the airport to the annex. Who is supposed to take you? So those are the decisions being contemplated and discussed in Washington. and this mistaken belief that there was an evacuation that was imminent without asking the pretty fundamental question of how do you expect us to effectuate this evacuation?
Ben, let me ask you a couple of things, and this is going back to the report. Apparently, both President Obama, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, ordered some military assets to at least begin to consider going to Libya, and nothing happened there. What did this report reveal about this, and what does it tell us?
Well, the report ultimately, I think, blames that on bureaucracy and policies. The report at least details that the orders went far beyond start to prepare to maybe go. The right. orders were go. And basically through, I think, a series of what seem in the report to be misunderstandings and quibbles over policy, then just disparate resources and assets scattered all over, not even Africa, but Europe. Nothing moved for more than 12 hours, essentially. And as someone who wrote in a note during the last segment noted, there were even military assets changing in and out of uniform as policymakers in Washington tried to figure out whether they would be safer in uniform or out of uniform.
In fact, quoting from the report, there's an anti-security or anti-terrorism security team that actually sat in a plane in Spain for 3 hours, and its members changed in and out of their uniforms 4 times. I mean, there's so many ways that you could take that. How do you see it, Ben?
I think, as I said, the explanation, or at least the point of view from military and diplomatic officials in Washington was that this was essentially a debate over whether or not they would be safer if they looked something like an invading force or if they were out of uniform. There is also the suggestion, or the strong suggestion, I should say, that the State Department was sensitive to Libyan reactions. You know, they didn't want to rile up the Libyan populace anymore, but they also didn't want to offend the Libyan government. It is, of course, their airspace that we would have to enter into. And the report condemns very much this seeming oversensitivity to diplomatic protocol, to feelings and hurt notions of appearance on the world stage, while four Americans were dying, and Ambassador Stevens unfortunately passed away quite early in the attack. So he wasn't dying, but his body had not been recovered, and his family didn't know his fate at that point. And the report does not spare policymakers who they feel dithered while those things happened.
Well, and just another thing that came out was that there was a meeting involving the White House, I believe involving Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, but the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was not there. Apparently he was at a dinner party, and some have said this was an example of the administration not taking this seriously enough. How do you read this?
You know, there are emergencies very often, and you don't always have every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, unless it's something like the Osama bin Laden raid, for instance, where people know beforehand that it's going to happen and everyone makes sure that they're going to be in the Situation Room. In the real world, military and diplomatic leaders move around the world. They have assignments, and, you know, if an emergency happens while that is going on, there are redundant systems. There are people who are put in charge when those people are out, you know, out of the office, as it were. Do I think that someone who was in Washington should have maybe been called back from the dinner? I do think that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and are things better? And by that, I mean, is this compound or what's ever left in Benghazi, is it more secure today?
Well, one of the things that they've done, you mentioned the team on the plane changing in and out of their uniforms. It's known as a FAST team, it is a military asset. It is a fleet anti-terrorism security team. They work between DOD and the Department of State, basically to protect diplomatic compounds. They were stationed in Spain and basically could not get to Benghazi, which is on the coast of Libya, you know, across the Mediterranean Sea. They have been moved much more closely, and their deployment has been reconsidered and their assets reallocated so that they could respond much more swiftly to a diplomatic incident of the magnitude that we that we saw, unfortunately, on September 11th, 2012, because incidents do occur at diplomatic compounds. We don't necessarily, fortunately, have them of this magnitude, but incidents do occur, and that sort of coordination is not necessarily a theoretical exercise.
I remember doing some interviews about Ambassador Stevens, who was known for liking being out in the world, you know, being a sort of a regular person walking in parts of Libya and talking to actual people on the ground. What can you tell us about him?
I certainly didn't know him, but by all accounts, left and right, Democrat and Republican, he was among the best that the U.S. Foreign Service had to offer. The U.S. Diplomatic Corps was quite lucky to have him representing us in Libya. He had become the ambassador officially only in May. It was a very short tenure, and people by and large said that he, as you say, loved to be out in the world. And that's basically what Clinton began her testimony in October with. She said that Ambassador Stevens stood behind the U.S. commitment to engage with the world, even sometimes in dangerous places, and that U.S. influence is needed in those places, as Clinton said she believed. And she said that Stevens fully stood behind that and really believed it. I think it's also important to note, you read a few emails from Stevens, as I have, as you read through these documents. There is an openness to the world and an excitement about his work that you don't always find in diplomatic communications when you read Stevens' communication.
Which, of course, makes it even more tragic. Let me get some callers into the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Mike from, looks like Germantown, to join us. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think it's a little too easy to immediately say this conspiracy is based, conspiracy theories are based in partisanship, when in fact, the immediate response, the talking points, politely called spin, you know, maybe more accurately called lies afterwards, and the fact that they completely ignored the ambassador's reports that things were escalating and things were getting more and more dangerous were ignored. I think there's where the real problem is. Is had they, you know, had they told the truth, it's just like Watergate. It isn't the incident; it's the cover up afterwards. And nobody's going to begin to confuse Hillary with Harry Truman, who said the buck stops here. So it's clear that the buck never even gets close to her.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Ben, Susan Rice certainly went on I think she went on five of those Sunday TV talk shows. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton didn't go on the shows, but nonetheless, Susan Rice did. And she did talk about this video as the inspiration for the attack on the compound in Benghazi.
Correct. And the report is not particularly kind to what she said, whether it was within the White House crafted talking points that the caller alluded to, or whether she had, as one government employee suggested, gone off the reservation. She was wrong, and the Obama administration seemingly was wrong at that moment. There are details of the ways that intelligence assessments were being made across the government, from the CIA and the FBI to the DOD. They detail a lot of confusion, but they also detail clearly that there were lots of people who did not believe that this was a protest, as the caller said. And there is no question that the government at least focused on something that certainly turned out not to be the real cause in the end.
Mike says they lied. Can you go that far, Ben? I mean, as you said, they were wrong. Were they lying?
I don't think I would go that far. Reading the intelligence reports, to my eyes, I read a lot of confusion, and I don't know much about the way these are consumed, evaluated, and passed around. But what little I do know suggests that there really wasn't a lot of clarity for at least 3 days, if not even several weeks, actually. It certainly became clearer as things went on. But there were numerous intelligence products. It can be hard to know how to weight them. It can be hard to know where their information is coming from. It can be hard to know how much Washington policymakers, who are literally writing up the pieces of paper, might be trying to synthesize information that simply doesn't exist from what we're getting from signals intelligence or assets on the ground. How much they're synthesizing something that's there, and how much they are putting down what they believe to be there and really taking it a little too far. It's not so different from journalism. We're constantly working to not go beyond what our sources tell us, but unfortunately sometimes we get it wrong.
Now, the Obama administration did withhold information. There were subpoenas. Were there not, Ben, for information?
There were. I think the State Department would say that they complied with what they understood the committee to be asking for. There's clearly information that did not go in there. One of the addendums to the report is a list of questions to the White House. And I think this goes back to some of the partisan things that you were talking about before. Tussles between the White House and executive privilege and separation of powers when it comes to oversight functions of Congress are common, but in this case, the White House, essentially declined to answer any questions beyond providing some of those talking points that the caller mentioned.
And that's Ben Brody again, writes for Bloomberg Politics, and we have been talking about the Benghazi report released yesterday. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Ben, let me read a couple of tweets. One from Jacqueline. Okay, so there's nothing here in terms of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Let's move on already. Hashtag I'm with her. Tweet from Nathan. We need a committee to investigate this committee. This was essentially a $7 million government-sponsored attack ad. A typical Republican smear campaign. And then an email from Fred saying, I wonder if your guests would compare Benghazi and the series of attacks on Americans in Lebanon back in 1983 that killed not four, but hundreds of Marines. I don't know if you can. That was obviously a terrible tragedy that happened under the Reagan administration. Ben, can you take us that far back?
It's a little bit before my time, but I can say that the oversight did not go on nearly as long or cost nearly as much. And it was viewed, despite certainly the partisanship of the Reagan era, which perhaps rivaled our own in many ways, was viewed sort of as a national tragedy that should be looked into for recommendations, but should ultimately be moved past.
Are there lessons learned then from both the attacks on Benghazi, but also from all these various investigations that have taken place over the last 4 years? Lessons learned that would give us some confidence that this country has learned something?
I think it would be hard to say. There certainly are recommendations at the end of the report. Some of those have been done, like the reorientation of the FAST team. Some of them haven't. They involve arcane rules of congressional oversight, whether or not you can hold someone in contempt of Congress. I think a lot of the lessons learned, at least vis-a-vis the investigation, may be relegated to the back pages of an 800-page report soon enough in history. And then I think the question becomes, did one of the chief policymakers under whose watch this occurred, and that's Hillary Clinton, who is, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, what did she learn? What should she have learned? And how do we proceed as we undertake U.S. foreign policy under a former Secretary of State as president?
Well, hopefully, and I think probably assuredly, those questions will be asked. Ben Brody, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Henny writes for Bloomberg Politics. Also talked with Philip Bump, who writes about politics for the Washington Post politics blog called The Fix. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Sorry about the technical problems that we had during this hour. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.